Welcome back for the third hour of Issues, Etc. It's good to be back from vacation. We are coming to you live Monday. It's June the 7th. We're going to pick up where we left off before that week of vacation in our series on working mothers, part 5 of our 7-part daily series with Suzanne Venker, a former middle school English teacher and author of the new book, 7 Myths of Working Mothers. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. And then, in the last half hour of the program, Congressman John Shimkus joins us from Illinois' 19th Congressional District. We're going to be talking about the Reagan legacy, and we'll be taking your phone calls on Ronald Reagan and his legacy there in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Suzanne Venker is a regular guest. She joins us for the latest in our series on working mothers. Suzanne, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
How are you doing after a week not talking?
Yeah. Well, I've been talking, just not to you guys. But it's nice to be back with you guys. You guys are my favorite.
One of the first media appearances that you did, this leads nicely into our myth for today that I'd like you to dispel. One of the first media appearances that you did nationally for your book was on CNN one evening, and I think it was a Sunday evening. And you were put up against, unbeknownst to you in advance, a person who was advocating for working mothers and for daycare and things like that. And you had asked rhetorically the question, how good of a mother can you be if you are not with your children 40 to 60 hours a week? And her response was, how could you not be a good mother for working that much? What did you mean by the question, and what did you make of her response?
Yeah, well, that response didn't really answer anything. But, you know, what she did was she was trying to get into this idea of there being good mothers and bad mothers. And I didn't respond the way that I should have, which, in retrospect, what I would have said is that, you know, the issue is not whether or not you're a good mother or a bad mother. The bottom line is, how can you possibly compare the work that a full-time mother does throughout the day, all week long, with the work that a, you know, full-time working mother does within an hour or two a day? And if you think about it, what I try to do is liken it to this. If you work, I don't know what your hours are, Todd, but let's say you work 5 days a week, 10 hours a day. And let's say somebody else were to come in, you know, one of those days of the week and work, you know, I don't know, 9 to 3. Would you expect that person to either, A, get the same results that you do, working twice as hard and long, and B, would you expect them to get the same pay? And, of course, nobody would say, yes, that's fine. So I'm saying, what is the difference in raising children? How is it that a working mother can expect to get the same results that a full-time mother does without doing that work?
Well, inside this myth, and the myth is, I'm a better mom for working, inside this myth is a rather interesting presupposition about children, it seems. And that is, you know, children are, they are malleable. They are very adaptive. And they will adapt to a situation like mom being gone for 40, 60 hours a week. They'll just adjust.
Well, they will in the sense that they're not going to have much choice, are they? They're not in control. We are. So whatever we ask them to do, or more likely make them do, they really don't have any control over, which goes back to the whole concept of children supposedly being okay with daycare. Well, as babies, when they're trying to tell you that they don't like it there, which, of course, the only way they can do that is by crying, we are ignoring them. And so eventually they become resigned to their fate. And in the case of, you know, moms who just simply aren't around, well, you know what? They just kind of get used to that. That doesn't mean that the results are going to be okay. That just means they've given up.
With our accelerated lifestyles, and you talk a lot about that in the course of your book, 7 Myths About Working Mothers, with our accelerated lifestyle, some people believe now that the pace has quickened and we have no choice. We can't slow down. Even if we wanted to, and some of us say, oh yeah, I do want to, we can't slow down. Is that true?
Of course it's not true. Anything we do in this life is a choice. We are the ones who are making our pace move the way that we are. We have the choice to slow down. Just because we have computers and other things that allow us to do things more efficiently doesn't mean we have to get carried away with it and not understand those things that we are going to have to do at a slower pace in order to do them well. And of course, nothing is a better example of that than raising children. So the way that I open this myth that we're talking about tonight is I use a quote that somebody said in one of their books called saying, children flourish when they are unhurried. And I thought that was so seemingly simple but so profound, because I can tell you the difference, as any mom can, the difference between a child who is not in a rush and who is not forced to work according to the schedule of his or her mom, or mom's work life, more accurately, and is living according to the life that children are meant to live. You know, children, everything that they do is extraordinarily slow. Bathing, dressing, eating, playing, learning, all of these things just happen to be a very slow process. And so while it's true that we as a society have changed and no longer move slowly like we did 40 years ago, the bottom line is children don't change. Their needs haven't changed, you know, since the beginning of time. It's only us that have changed, we who have changed. So it is necessary for us to realize that there are going to be consequences for forcing children to accommodate our new lifestyle rather than our accommodating to their lifestyle. And that's the focus of this chapter.
You have written something therein that I found very interesting, and I'd like you to explain it, if you would. You write, women actually believe, or have talked themselves into believing, that they can raise their children with leftover time. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, well, it's kind of going back to what we were talking about a minute ago. How can you possibly accomplish such an awesome task as raising children into an hour or two a day? To be able to, or to attempt to compare, as I said, that with somebody who's doing that work day in and day out is just preposterous. And in order for our children are going to know when they are squeezed into an otherwise hectic and more important life. They know it. They know it from the moment they come out. They're asking us, in effect, to stop and pay attention to them and focus on them. But as we wake up in the morning at 5 o'clock and drag them out of bed at 6 o'clock and throw some semblance of, you know, breakfast in their mouth and throw them off into the car and then drop them off and say, see you later, 8 to 10 hours later, the idea that this is not affecting them greatly simply because at that age they can't yet articulate how it's affecting them is foolish, really, when you think about it.
You tell the story about Jane Sullivan, who is written about in Newsweek, and how her son dealt with this kind of being squeezed into her lifestyle when it came to time to do homework. Tell us about it.
Yeah. He purposely took an hour to do what should have been a 15-minute assignment. And she could tell that, of course, just being a mom. She could see how long the assignment should take for his age. And he purposely made it take an hour for, you know, I mean, that doesn't take, you know, great brain power to understand why. I mean, he wanted to spend time with her, and that's what they do. So he probably just, I didn't get the details on this, but I can kind of imagine it as a former teacher, you know, just dragged it out and tried to talk about other things, anything to get her to just sit still with him for an hour.
Now, this is something that I think a lot of parents can probably, I mean, sometimes kids are just move slowly because they're moving slowly.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it is, even if I have to be bad in order to get my parents' attention.
Right, absolutely. And hence the discipline problem, you know. And again, the focus of this chapter, not just on the slowness, but also this connection, this connecting the dots between what's happening to our children today and the fact that mothers aren't at home. That's really the focus of this chapter. I mean, you turn on the TV and you see, you know, Katie Couric talking about all these different problems that children have, discipline, school, obesity, manners, whatever they are, sleep deprivation, that's a huge one. And we watch her wrinkle her eyebrows, and what's going on with children today? I just don't get it, you know, and they have these experts on there to tell us things like, well, you know, our children are just too sedentary, or they watch too much TV, or they should be out playing. Well, yes, duh, but how is that going to happen if there isn't a mother or father in the home to see that it happens? But, of course, they neglect to mention that part because that's the part that's not PC to say. So, of course, we never get to the heart of the problem because we won't talk about that elephant in the room.
So we hear so much about various disorders, attention deficit mm-hmm. disorders, not to get too much into that topic, but we hear about that. You mentioned obesity. We hear about all these things that are afflicting our children. Could they have that common denominator, at least in a vast majority of cases of parents and in particular mothers, buying into the myth of quality over quantity time with their kids?
Well, there's no question about it. There's no question about it. And again, what I basically say in the chapter is, what on earth did we think mothers were for? I mean, if we can just stop that work and go do something else, and then we see these kids with the problems, and then, as I say, we wrinkle our eyebrows and we're curious as to how it's happened, well, what did we think mothers were doing all these years, over the decades? Eating bonbons? You know, they were doing things. They were working at raising their children. And there are positive results to doing that work. And if you do not do it, then you suffer the consequences, which we are doing today.
So in essence, it sounds as though, at least at this point and this myth, we are talking about a very, and this is one of the great approaches of your book, it's very nuts and bolts. Sometimes it is just a matter of dollars and cents and figuring out that it actually costs you more to work than it does mm-hmm. and have someone else to raise your children. Or in this case, we're talking about the number of hours we spend with our kids.
Right, absolutely. And what we know from all the data that's been collected is that the number of hours that we spend with our children absolutely matters. There's no shortcut to it. You cannot rush them and expect them to get the same results as somebody who's putting in her time.
We're talking with Suzanne Venker. She's a former middle school English teacher, author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. This part five in our seven-part daily series on working mothers with Suzanne. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go first to Kathy, who's calling from St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a couple of things I wanted to ask. One, I wanted to just bring up a personal story. I'm a stay-at-home mom, but we came about the stay-at-home mom thing through personal difficulty. I had an undiagnosed rare condition called celiac sprue, and after I had my first child, I was physically not able to go back to work, and 9 months after I had him, I was diagnosed. So I couldn't go back to work because I physically could not stand and work all day. I just didn't have the strength. I had other health problems related to that undiagnosed condition. So we had to make ends meet, and our income was cut in half. My husband's salary at the time, when he brought home a monthly salary, it took two-thirds of his salary to make the house payment. A month, and so we had to live on the other third. So I've had people tell me then, since then, that and it's better for us now, but at the time it was very difficult. We had split pea soup a lot, and I told my son that it was dinosaur goo, so he learned to appreciate the goodness of split pea soup from a kid's perspective. And we were given lots of tomatoes, so I made a lot of homemade spaghetti sauce. But I've had people tell me, oh, it's nice that you can stay home. They don't understand. It's not because I live in the lap of luxury that I stay home. The Lord showed us that you can make do on a whole lot less than you think.
And you had another point that you wanted to make, Kathy?
Well, it was just that, you know, what do you say to people who say, oh, it's so mm-hmm. nice you can stay home, like as if it's a choice, you know, that I must have the financial luxury to be able to do so, when really it is not it is a choice, but it doesn't, it's not because we have so much luxury that I'm able to do it. So what is a good response to people who say that?
Thank you, Kathy. Suzanne, your reaction first to her story, her own personal experience there, and then to her question.
Well, yeah, I mean, her story is a great one, and she's a prime example of what I mean as far as what can be done when one needs to do it, one must do it, one chooses to do it, however you come about it, it can be done, and that's her point, really. My only suggestion to her when she's asked that is to just very simply say, I'm not rich. End of story. There's nothing, I'm not rich. I just do it. It's a very hard thing because I can tell you most of my friends are absolutely not rich by any stretch of the imagination. And I've had them tell me how they're standing there in front of somebody else who says the same thing to them. And sometimes they say nothing, and sometimes they try to get their word in by saying something to the effect of what I just suggested. But it's hard, but it's important to respond in some way that makes you feel proud to know that they're the ones who are constructing this lie, and you are living the truth. And it's important for you to be able to feel proud of that, and if you need and want to say something, you know, have some sort of retort for that, to feel that you need to say that, you will probably shut them up very quickly. That would be my guess.
Let's talk about a few of the very, as I said before, nuts and bolts issues here that bear upon a mother. Well, you're actually brave enough to define what a good mother is. Would you do that first? And let's talk about things like our kids' health, their sleep, and their exercise, and all those kind of things.
Definitely. And that's a very important question because, again, feminists and child care advocates want to make this out to be that people like myself, who, you know, espouse what I espouse, believes in a good mother, a perfect mother versus a bad mother. And I never said anything like that. And that's not the point. It's just kind of redirecting the issue. The issue is that we as parents are responsible for the nutrition, the health, our children's discipline, school-related matters, all of these things that make up raising a human being. We are responsible for that. If we opt out of that because we just don't wish to do it, then that's what would, it's not a matter of being a bad mother, you're just not doing it at all. So the good mother, as I describe her here, is one who sees her responsibility as being the overseer of these things, as opposed to the person who feels that she can farm that out to anybody because it's just not that important. So we look at the sleep thing, for example. We have a major problem with sleep deprivation in this country, and this did not exist 40 years ago, and we, again, wonder, how is that so? Well, why do we think that is? All of a sudden, as I said before, we're asking children to accommodate our lifestyle. We're the ones who have to be at work at 7:30, 8 o'clock. We're the ones waking them up before they're even awake, and then not giving them the proper breakfast, rushing them off to this place, not giving them adequate naps during the day because we're not there to see that it happens. And besides, you can't sleep, you know, well anyway in a room full of other people. So there's no routine. There's no consistency in these children's lives, and that is what they crave and need to have a happy, healthy demeanor, to be responsive to their mother's disciplining style. You cannot expect to be gone 50 hours a day and then come home at the end of the day and think that your child's going to listen to you because you haven't done the work to establish that relationship with him or her so that they then listen to you when you tell them to do something. Why should they? You haven't fostered that. So that's what makes a mother good, if that's the word you want to define. Just doing it, not necessarily doing it perfectly, you're going to screw up along the way. We all do. Of course we do. But just doing it as opposed to not doing it, that's the difference between the good mom and the bad mom, I guess.
Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, this is Bill Venker. I'm Suzanne's husband. Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Bill.
Hi, I just wanted to say something really quick about, you guys were talking about mothers, working mothers, full-time mothers, and really, if you put it from the perspective that fathers who work full-time in the business world, really we're just part-time parents. We come home, we're halfway in the middle of things. We don't always get the full clue of what's going on. Not to say that I tried very hard to be a good father, but I don't have the amount of time to devote to it. That's why my wife is there to raise the children. And one other thing I just wanted to kick in here is that you were talking about children. Suzanne was mentioning the fact that children will survive anything. They will adapt, and that's true. And they will flourish when you have someone there working with them every day, giving them the attention they need. And I think what's going to happen to us, unfortunately, is when these children who are in homes where both parents work, those children will grow up very much with the mentality of almost being children of divorce, because their parents aren't there.
That's a good insight. Bill, before I let you go, what's it like to be Suzanne's husband?
Oh, it's wonderful. I have the most incredible wife in the whole world.
That is great to hear. Bill, thank you very much for the call. What he said there about the husband coming home and getting, playing catch up.
Yes.
I depend, now my wife works during the school hours when my kids are in school, but she's there with them on all other hours. I depend entirely upon her when I come home to basically brief me on what's been going on in a relevant way, and I'm still playing catch up with that. If she was not there and we were both trying to play catch up, I can only imagine what would happen.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so hence the fallout when you have both people coming home and nobody knows what's going on and kids aren't listening to you anyway because, again, nobody's established that healthy working relationship with them. And they're not living, most importantly, this is a big one as far as this chapter goes, they're not living on a routine, a healthy routine where life functions according to their needs, not the needs of mom. And that's what we've done with motherhood. We've made motherhood an issue about what women need instead of what children need. And then we wonder why it doesn't work.
So when you mentioned before the good mother who realizes that her responsibility lies in coordinating and overseeing mm-hmm. the needs of her children, that those needs are met, you're really talking about not only it being a priority, but the priority.
Oh, definitely, the priority. And that any other work that you pursue, whether it's paid or unpaid, there's lots of volunteer work that women have done for centuries, really, but for decades that has been helpful to our society. So regardless of what you do outside of raising children, just do it around their needs and their schedules. That's all that I'm really purporting in this book.
Suzanne, we're going to have you back tomorrow to talk about the sixth myth in your book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. This one being, my children just love daycare. With only 30 seconds, give us a brief preview.
Oh, my brief preview. My brief preview would be that very few people know the truth about daycare because they are not going to get the information that they need from mainstream media because most people in mainstream media use daycare. So therefore, they have a vested interest in daycare being a good thing and have no interest in hearing what is not good about it.
Suzanne Venker is a former middle school English teacher and author of the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Suzanne, thank you for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd.
Folks, you can purchase Suzanne Venker's new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers, by calling Spence Publishing toll-free 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. Or you can go online to SpencePublishing.com, www.SpencePublishing.com. Look for the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois, his thoughts on the passing of Ronald Reagan and the Reagan legacy, and your phone calls as well on Ronald Reagan, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Call during this break. We'll be talking with Congressman Shimkus and with you at the same time, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Give us your reflections. Tell us what you think about the late President Ronald Reagan, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Think about this for a moment when it comes to, this is in advance of our conversation with Suzanne tomorrow on daycare. Would you want to go to daycare? Lots of people look, when they walk into the grade school, boy, I wish I could go back to these days of coloring and cutting out things. Think about it this way. Would you want to go to daycare all day long? I wouldn't. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Which of the laws of the Old Testament apply to Christians today and which do not? More importantly, why don't they? How does a scriptural understanding of Jesus Christ as the fulfiller of the whole law answer these questions? In our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June, you'll find answers to these questions, and you'll discover how Christ speaks in the Old Testament. You can order our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus, by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or visit our website, issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. When you call or write, mention Issues, Etc. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
A spark plug used by an ape man?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the editors of the faith-building Creation magazine. Well, Ken, you don't even believe in ape men, so how can you even say they had spark plugs?
Well, a friend of mine was vacationing in California. As he walked along the beach, he discovered a rock with a spark plug embedded in it. Now, most people have been given the impression that it takes a long time, even millions of years, for rocks to form. As my friend showed me this intriguing rock, I smiled and said with tongue in cheek, "People who think that rocks like this take a long time to form may think an ape man millions of years ago used this spark plug." Actually, an examination of the type of spark plug found in this rock showed that clearly it couldn't have been made before 1950. Sometime during the last 50 years, this spark plug ended up in the ocean, perhaps dropped overboard by a fisherman. During that time, sand grain cemented around the spark plug, producing this fascinating specimen. Of course, the point of all this is that it doesn't take millions of years for rocks to form. Under the right conditions, rocks can form quite quickly. It's just another piece of evidence that illustrates there's nothing in observational science that contradicts a young age for the Earth, as we'd expect from reading the Bible's history.
What about the dinosaurs? Don't they show that the Earth is millions of years old? Read Ken Ham's fascinating free booklet on dinosaurs when you go to our attractive website, AnswersRadio.com. You'll be built up in your faith, and we can train you to become more effective in your evangelism. Go to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Early sexual intercourse among adolescents represents a major public health problem. That is the word from the American Academy of Pediatrics. Their report goes on to say, quote, "Although early sexual activity may be caused by a variety of factors, the media are believed to play a significant role. In film, television, and music, sexual messages are becoming more explicit, and these messages contain unrealistic, inaccurate, and misleading information that young people accept as fact," end quote. It's important to remind our teens that Christ died on the cross to save them from immorality and its harmful consequences. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org.
You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
That, of course, was President Ronald Reagan in 1984 during the second debate with Walter Mondale answering a reporter's question about his age. He died this weekend, of course, as the oldest president in U.S. history. Not only oldest president while he served, but the longest lived president in U.S. history. We're joined by Congressman John Shimkus here in this last half hour of Issues, Etc. from the 19th Congressional District of Illinois to talk about the Reagan legacy. And we'd also like to talk with you about it as well in the midst of this conversation with Congressman Shimkus. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Line up there and let's talk about the legacy of Ronald Reagan. Congressman Shimkus, welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
First of all, in light of that, the soundbite that we just heard from Ronald Reagan back in 1984, your reflection on Reagan's wit.
Well, that's one of the great moments in political presidential debates. And if you remember that shot, Walter Mondale just broke up laughing. And it it's good for us to see that, and even in a tense political debate, you can accept a good joke, and I think that's one of his styles that was very successful for President Reagan.
When were you first elected to Congress, Congressman Shimkus?
Well, 96 election, so I took office in 97. But my memory goes back to in West Point under the Carter administration and graduating in West Point in 1980, of course, right during the election and the like, and then serving as an officer in the Army under the commander-in-chief of Ronald Reagan. And I think I am like many, probably especially Republican, conservative politicians, that if there's one person that probably excited and encouraged and motivated us to be involved in the political process, I think overwhelmingly Ronald Reagan would be the name that most Republicans would cite, whether it's in state government or local or at the federal level. I know a lot of my colleagues worked in the Reagan administration. So his legacy, he really lives on through those who became involved in active public policy through elected office following President Ronald Reagan.
He is credited, at least he is being credited in the press nowadays after his death, with having a big hand in the Republican sweep in 1986, but then also in 1994. Do you consider yourself part of that wave, the Reagan wave?
Yeah, I do. I think that what President Reagan did was bring over what was defined as the Reagan Democrats to what we call conservative Democrats, who understand the message of conservatism. There's many of them in the state of Missouri and many of them in southern Illinois. Less government, individual responsibility, lower taxes translates into more personal freedoms and liberties, strong on defense, respect for life. Those are conservative values, and the major part of now the Republican Party platform, which Ronald Reagan and his presidency gets credit for.
You say you served in the Army after graduating from West Point during Reagan's administration with him as commander-in-chief. What was that like? What was the mood in the military under Reagan's leadership?
Well, what we saw was a change from a military that was forgotten and in essence left out, to one that started receiving the funds needed to equip, maintain, and train and create a professional force. I mean, the Army at the end of Vietnam was demoralized and dejected and kind of went back into the United States and kind of cowered. The military around the world was in disarray as far as leadership, both officer and non-commissioned officer. What Reagan did through his focus on really patriotism and honor and the honor of serving your country was help the military get back on the proper footing. He has to get a lot of credit with the transformation that we've seen in the military and the fact that we have now the best, most professional military force in the world today.
It was also those days in which you served as an officer in the Army, the very end of the Cold War. How did that factor into it?
Well, peace through strength. Not backing down. You know, the other famous lines, and I'm sure it's being replayed over and over today, when Reagan is in Berlin asking Mr. Gorbachev to tear down that wall. I was in Europe when he called the Soviet Union the evil empire. I was there when he tried to deploy the Pershing 2 missiles, and with great outcry from our European allies. I actually, in my basement, I have a poster of a protest poster against the Pershing 2 and how the young Germans at the time wanted to throw them out. Remember that there was debate on the neutron bomb. All these things showing a strong stand against the Soviet Union is credited with the ultimate collapse.
And in terms of the buildup of the military during that time, it was done, of course, with quite a bit of opposition from people outside the president's party, also some within the president's party. How necessary was that, given the fact that we were still standing toe-to-toe in Western Europe, and in Germany in particular, with a communist dictatorship or a communist fascist empire there?
Well, I think most of us who served, especially those who served fairly close to the front lines, I served in, my unit was in Bavaria. We had defensive positions on the Czech border. We knew we had first the Czech army to meet, then we would meet the East Germans. And then most of us felt that that was it for us. I mean, the East Germans, after a second engagement, would probably have rolled over us. And we just, in essence, had to slow down the assault, hopefully getting to, you know, the Soviet units. But, you know, you can only do that with a strong military. And I think you can only build that type of force and commitment through a moral faith and foundation. You just can't spend that amount of dollars unless you really believe that the cause is right and the cause is just. And it's not unlike some of the debates we're having today about democracy and freedom and the cost. The cost is high, but the returns are great.
We're talking with Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois about the Reagan legacy. We invite your questions and your comments, but also your phone calls on Ronald Reagan, your thoughts on the passing of this former president. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Where were you then, John, when you heard about the death of Ronald Reagan, and what was your reaction?
Well, I was in Effingham, actually a small community called Shumway, at a farmer friend of mine who was having a evening dinner, outdoor picnic on my behalf. And as the people were coming to the farm, it was mentioned to me then. And I think a lot of people are somewhat relieved. It gives us a chance to reflect and remember President Reagan, and that's what's going on this week, which I think is very, very important. But two, he suffered for a long time with Alzheimer's, and most families understand that and have someone connected with that illness. And it's not fun. It's very difficult. It's very challenging. It's nice to know that he's at rest.
You spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. Before we go to the phone calls here, how different a place do you think Washington, and government in particular, is after Ronald Reagan rather than before?
Well, I think in every era you have challenges, and what President Reagan did was bring back the spirit of America and a focus on individual freedoms and liberties and sacrifice and an optimism, and it's nice to be optimistic. And it's tough business. It's a tough world. I'm sure he would like to see the government transform itself, being a conservative, to focusing on or core competencies and getting out of some of the areas that we find ourselves in, and downsizing government, cutting more taxes, being more efficient. He's probably not pleased that we haven't been able to do that yet, but we keep working at it.
505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with our listeners about Ronald Reagan. Chris is calling from Breeze, Illinois. Chris, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Yes, Ronald Reagan, I had such a deep affection for him. I've never felt that, I guess, for a leader since then. I certainly respect and like President Bush. But I just miss that guy, and Saturday night when they had the TV special on, I just realized how much I missed him and that smile and everything about him. Congressman, I know it's an impossibility and everything's probably already in place, is in place, but it sure would be great if somehow that casket could make a stop here in Illinois before it gets to California. I'd sure like to pay my respects. So maybe you could ask the president to ask the former first lady.
Chris, thank you very much. Of course, President Reagan was born in Illinois, wasn't he, Congressman Chimkus?
He sure was. Dixon, Illinois, and then I went to school in, I think, around the Peoria area for college. I know there's going to be, I was told today, funeral services in those two communities. The schedule is already preset. I will relay the fact that people would like to have a chance, like in the old days when the casket and the president, get transported in a train where then you can stand along the route. I think the burial in California is Friday or Saturday. The funeral at the is going to be Friday. I guess the burial's on Saturday. So they've got it pretty well scoped out, and I'm just one of 435, and I'm not really up in the echelons, and this is a family decision.
Now, this will be the first state funeral, which involves an incredible amount of planning and the shutdown of government for an entire day, which is monumental in and of itself. This will be the first state funeral since, I believe, Lyndon Johnson, if I'm not mistaken. Of course, we still have a lot of living presidents,
right,
who will probably get them as well.
Right.
What's going to happen in Washington, D.C. in the next couple of days?
Yeah, 30 years is what I've been told. Actually, the whole week's gone. It started today. I think the Senate started doing some commentary and discussions and debates on President Reagan's legacy. He is being, obviously, the casket is in California today and tomorrow. It gets flown back to Washington. Then they get to the White House for a procession to the Capitol for Wednesday service, Thursday for the public, maybe Wednesday for the public too, and then Friday the funeral at the National Cathedral, and then back to California. So pretty much we'll have a couple votes this week. They'll all be pro forma things that we have to do, and then some honorary decrees. But other than that, it'll be mostly spending time and making sure that the nation's well represented by the members of Congress at these formal functions.
This is going to be a pretty monumental security endeavor, both in California, the transport, and especially in Washington, D.C., won't it?
Yeah, I think so. Anytime there's a large gathering of national leaders and international leaders, security will be stepped up quite a bit. We've had stepped up security now for a long time, and I don't know if there's any great fears being placed by those. And we got professionals, and they work very hard, and it's really part of the job now. If you accept this responsibility to try to represent your constituents, you have to live in this environment.
We're talking with Congressman John Chimkus about the Reagan legacy. Your phone calls as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Not only your questions, but also your thoughts on the passing of Ronald Reagan, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Congressman, do you expect there to be any talk of any kind of a memorial, and I'm speaking in terms of a permanent memorial, for this president?
Well, Reagan, there's always proposals and bills in. He has a huge federal building named after him. He has the national airport named after him. There's already discussions about getting his picture on currency. He's pretty well represented already.
Well, I tell you what, if you want my suggestion, Congressman, there's room on Mount Rushmore.
Oh, my.
There's still room there.
Yeah.
And that might be fitting.
That's going to be take some heavy lifting for a while. I think there's still going to be opposition to that.
Well, here's my suggestion. Make it a dual thing, because I know that there will be people who will oppose it, but they probably would like to see FDR up there. So
probably
get both. We've already got Teddy up there.
Right.
Put Franklin Delano up there. And while you're up there and got all the equipment going, it wouldn't be a bad idea to have Ronald Reagan's visage
as well. There you go. FDR did not want a memorial, and he got one a couple of years ago. It's very nice, pretty fitting. So I'm not saying that there will not be one eventually for Reagan.
All right. So without talking out of school too much, Congressman, what do you make today over the last couple of days? Many of the president's harshest critics when he was, not so much when he was alive, but of course when he was serving as president, are now today singing his praises. They seem to have done at least a temporary about-face. What do you make of this?
I'm one that, you know, you let bygones be bygones, and this is a time. We went back to Washington after Memorial Day week, and now we have, anniversary of D-Day. It's really nice to get back to Washington where people are focusing on bigger things and talking about sacrifice and service and stuff, and it gets pretty burdensome to flip back into the partisan bickering that we do so easily in Washington. So I don't mind it. I think it will help his legacy, and for those of us who are Reagan fans and believe that's the right ideology, and we would like more people to, you know, look at themselves and decide where they stand on the how government should run side. Maybe this will swing them over to take a good look to the conservative causes.
A couple things on a few things you just mentioned there. First of all, the D-Day anniversary, 60th anniversary of the storming of the beaches at Normandy. What did you do for this anniversary?
Well, I do very much. I mean, I did the Memorial Day stuff previously, and at the Memorial Day, I obviously mentioned the D-Day, and I mentioned the opening of the World War II memorial. But as far as any official D-Day acknowledgement or activity, there was none, just following the events overseas.
And have you had the opportunity to visit the new World War II memorial on the Mall in Washington?
I have not walked through it yet. I've driven by it a couple times, but I have not walked around to see the water and the pools, and which I hope to do. And actually, this week might be a good week, as it'll end up being pretty slow, and it's really not too far from where I have my where I live or where I room when I'm out in Washington.
With those two things together, Congressman Shimkus, your reflections on D-Day and the sacrifice of at least on that one day of tens of thousands of American Allied lives on that day that was the turning point for the war in Europe.
Yeah, the stories of the survivors are huge, and we get a chance to hear some of those when we think back. And, you know, I always, as having taught history, understanding the sacrifices, I always try to say, well, how does that relate today? What are we doing today? See, and I think the sacrifice of our young men and women who are in harm's way is as noble and as right a cause as the battle during World War II. The difference was this is beamed into our home, and we're doing a daily count, whether it's really a tally or by, you know, a soldier here today, two soldiers tomorrow. And it's kind of a death by a thousand cuts, where in the D-Day invasion, I mean, we didn't get the stories. And the first pictures of dead soldiers in World War II came after the D-Day invasion. How would the American public responded at all the loss of life in World War II had they, you know, had the media exposure we have today?
Finally, on the subject of Ronald Reagan, President Bill Clinton was famous for saying that the era of big government is over, obviously echoing many of the thoughts of one of his predecessors, that Ronald Reagan. Would he have been able to say that? Would we have had a president say that were it not for President Ronald Reagan?
No. I think what happened in Clinton's presidency is an example. The governing majority of the country is the center-right majority that wants to see, you know, again, the things that Reagan espoused. Clinton ran as a Southern conservative, in essence, governor from Arkansas. Now, so the nation has changed to a center-right governing majority. Now, it's a tenuous majority, and it's not strong enough to really change government as many of us would like to see, but at least it's there and not a center-left, which could happen if people aren't vigilant.
How was Reagan able to make the term liberal, a word that people didn't want to claim, the L word? How was he able to do that?
Oh, I don't know. I just I think that Reagan was just a believable, lovable character that you, a grandfatherly type of guy. I mean, and you look at, we all love, most people love their grandfather. You trust them. They've been around the block. They have the wisdom of ages. And I think that in carrying the mantle of conservatism, by default, anything other that was not as a positive or a positive approach to public policy. So I think it was more a leadership by example, and we just wanted to believe and trust in him, and I think that's how it evolved.
Congressman John Shimkus, thank you for taking the time to be with us here on Issues Etc.
My pleasure. Always enjoyable.
Congressman John Shimkus is congressman from the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about Harry Potter. Of course, the latest movie did open this weekend. My daughter went to see it. I haven't seen it yet. She says, best ever. Does look pretty amazing, in fact. We'll be talking with Pastor Todd Peppercorn of the youth magazine Higher Things tomorrow about Harry Potter. Also, tune in tonight to Issues Etc. as it's rebroadcast from 8 to 9 this evening. And you'll hear the first hour of today's broadcast. We'll talk about the doctrine of the Trinity in the Old Testament and in the New Testament with Drs. Lewis Brighton and Walter A. Meyer III. That's tonight at 8 o'clock on AM 850 KFUO. Tune in again for the rebroadcast of the first hour of today's Issues Etc. Well, you know, some final thoughts here in the brief seconds I have. Reagan ran largely against the government to be elected to be its president for two terms. One of the things I heard today that I found interesting was that during Reagan's term, the public opinion about government actually went up. He ran against government. Remember, government's not the solution, it's the problem. During his term, the public opinion of government went up. If something could be said of Ronald Reagan in memoriam as a politician that would probably hold him in good stead, it would be that he showed the American people, whether they liked his policies and his ideas or not. I think most people liked him. Even if they didn't like him, he showed them what good government was all about, what good government could be. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.